Blew up their society, too.
I don't want to raise your hopes. Yes, definitely.
Fry, this is Professor Farnsworth.
I surrender and volunteer for treason.
Shut up and take my money.
You're a cartoon. You're not real.
Really? If I weren't real, could I do this? Oh, hello.
That's why the robot's immune. He has no soul.
Life force!
What's up, Ren?
Nothing, Rover. Go back to your doghouse.
Name's Billy West.
Billy West. What a stupid, phony, made-up name.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Radio Labyrinth Presents. I'm your host, Tim Andrews. Joining me in a moment will be Jeff Lieboff and our guest this week, who is the amazing voiceover talent, Billy West. So if you're a fan of Ren and Stimpy, if you're a fan of Futurama, if you're a fan of people who do voices for the M&Ms or even Honey Nut Cheerios or even going way, 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 way back, the Howard Stern radio show back in the late 80s and early 90s, or the WOR TV show. The list is endless. Ladies and gentlemen, please join us in welcoming the great Billy West. Hello, Billy West. How are you, man?
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Thank you so much. This is a huge honor for both of us. I'm Tim, and that's Jeff.
Thank you. Pleasure to meet both of you.
Yeah, man. We just finished listening to you on the 400th episode of the Gilbert Gottfried Amazing Colossal podcast.
Oh, he's got such a fun, great show. I've known the guy for many, many years. And when he started doing his podcast, I never thought that I'd be like a candidate to be on a show. But the thing is, I get him.
Yes.
You know, I totally get him and dig him. And I have the same sort of, I don't know, whatever you want to call it, scrambled, askew. you know, stop me before I sub-reference again.
Stuff like this?
Yes.
This old dog-eared copy I've had since 90.
Of Drew Friedman's book?
Yeah. All the Stooge stuff that's in there.
That stuff inspired me because I met him early on. I was living in New York and my friend Eddie Gordetsky, who's a producer, comedy producer, he introduced me to Drew Friedman back when I lived in New York, and we used to just hang around and like inspire each other with nonsense. You know, I mean, anybody listening in would go, this is the biggest waste of time. What is it with these fucking guys? You know, this is sit around and yank each other's chain over lunch, you know, at the Fez. And oh boy.
Yeah. Well, that stuff is fun. And I, you know, maybe a couple of, well, more than a couple of years separated between when we were young, but the same thing applies. You know, we lived in North Central Pennsylvania in a town called Mansfield that no one's ever heard of, but we had WPIX. That was our big affiliate. So every weekend, Abbott and Costello, every day, Three Stooges, and then Odd Couple and Honeymooners and all that stuff. So even though we weren't close, we still got that New York feel.
Yes. You know, before I went to school, every morning they used to show the Three Stooges in Detroit where I grew up. And I hated school because I was learning disabled. And I didn't realize it. I had the devil of a time and still kind of do reading, you know, just reading straight stuff. You'd think, you know, somebody in my business, I'm in serious trouble if I can't read right. But I managed to work my way around a lot of stuff, but you know, I had ADD and OCD and my dad thought I was stupid. So I hated school. I used to get physically sick. The idea of going to school would make me sick. So I watched the Three Stooges in the morning. And it's so funny. I went to school with a head full of them and I hated academia. And in the year 2022, anything and everything I learned or supposed to learn in school would have no practical application.
No.
Not one. I should have started thumbing when I was seven. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But all those wasted years, I could have joined the circus or something.
I used algebra one time in my life. I'm 52 years old.
Yeah.
I've only ever needed algebra one time.
I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but Whether people learn math or not, they just did a survey saying the IQ of the American people in the past like 100 years has dropped 14 points.
Probably all. Look,
I'm going to see Jackass. I'll see you later.
So you grew up in Detroit. How did you find your way to Boston? Is that where you got your first radio job, or did you get a job in Detroit?
It was 1963. I lived in a horror house, a hell house. My dad was psychotic, alcoholic, abusive, everything. And one day my mom at 32 years old took three boys, you know, out of school and went to Boston, where she had family. And I thought that was pretty courageous, you know, but she saved our lives. When I look back, she saved our lives. So that's how I wound up in Boston. But, you know, I had the same interests. You know, I was a loner. I never felt like I fit in. I had a nifty collection of Famous Monsters of Filmland, the Forrest J. Ackerman publication, which was like a Bible. It had everything. And I just used to read them over and over. I used to live for the thing to come out. I mean, I'd walk for miles up to a train station and then pay to go through the turnstile so I could go to the newsstand and buy the damn magazine and then just leave, come back downstairs.
Did you collect the Universal Monsters figures and stuff too?
Yes, but they were too expensive. I just lusted after them. I managed to get a couple later on. I didn't grow up all that fast. You know, I was kind of, I don't want to say I was infantilized. I was just fixated and on peripheral stuff, you know, just like I don't know. I can't tie a necktie to this day. You could show me 125,000 times. I still won't be able to do it. I can't tie my shoe. I do a mock-up of what it's supposed to look like.
Yeah,
I can't do it. I can't buckle a car belt without all kinds of fucking problems. I don't know what it is, but so I'm on the autism spectrum, but I'm high functioning. And but ask me to do one, you know, ask me to do a stupid Beatrice Arthur impression, you know, Rouge, Ma Blanche.
Ahmad, what are you doing getting an abortion? This is national television.
Yeah, I love that. You sound like Bill Macy.
That's what I'm trying to do. Yeah.
Maud. Oh, shut up, Walter.
I told you, no more. You know, Florida can do whatever she wants. Jens doesn't want to work in here anymore.
I got to bring you on Gilbert's show with me.
I love Bill Macy. And
I did too.
51, and I did a Bill Macy impression on the radio show that I'm on in like a couple months ago. And my host, yeah, the host knows who I'm doing, but he's like, nobody knows who the fuck you're doing.
Well, every town weirdo knows. That's all that counts.
Right.
You know, and eventually those town weirdos go to a place like where I live, and it's Mecca. You know, it's all town weirdos that are producing movies.
Yep.
You know, writing them, and yeah.
The radio thing, just when I was a kid, I would listen to any kind of talk radio, any kind of music radio. Mm-hmm. And when I got a little older, I started noticing you get stations from other cities. So
yes.
I was listening to Soupy Sales if the weather was clear, and mm-hmm. Wolfman, and, you know, and then sometimes I could get Howard in the afternoon when he was on WNBC. But my heroes were like local guys and, of course, Howard Hessman, who we just lost. And
yes.
And it's just, that's kind of what I did. I listened to the radio. I was, you know, pretty much raised an only child. So it was TV, radio, records, and comic books and stuff. So
I retreated into all those same things. It's, I'm sure we have like a total parallel
mm-hmm.
development, because my world was a sonic world. You know, there were only like 2.5 channels when I was a little kid. Maybe three. Yeah, there was three channels and then a fourth one, but it was all pixels and snow and protons. And
right.
You know, I mean, I listened to a lot of local guys. I was fascinated with microphones from the age of 2. I used to take a potato masher and stand it up and it looked like the microphone that John Daly used to use on What's My Line.
Yeah.
You know, and I would just sit in the window with that thing and I would just, you know, looking for that Guidry fastball.
It's kind of Jeff and
Ron Guidry fastball.
Ron Guidry, what a name.
Yeah, I know.
Jeff and I would do little shows and skits, and we every year we would raise money for Jerry Lewis, but it was just an excuse for us to go answer phones at the local.
Tell me you didn't give it to him.
Oh, no, we
we gave it to him.
I thought you were going to say it was an excuse to not give it to him. No.
It was an excuse to to prank people. Jeff would
say, hey, you too.
Where are my Nickelodeon guys?
Oh, yeah. Well, he was great. Whatever you did for him, I'm sure that you've been rewarded karmically.
We would go door to door and raise money and then go answer phones at the affiliate. And this guy, this other guy that I'm on here with would prank and, you know, mess with the people in the front. And we had a lot of fun. And it was just so we could be on TV and make faces at our friends who are at home, but also to raise money for Jerry.
How cool the idea to even get near television.
Mm-hmm.
I used to sit in front of that thing. We had an old Muntz television set, M-U-N-T-Z. And the first thing that I ever got to see was your show of shows with Sid Caesar. My mom used to let me stay up. This is in the 50s.
Yeah.
And let me stay up and watch this guy that profoundly impacted me, including the cast, which had the greatest of the greats, Carl Reiner, Howie Morris, Imogene Coca. You know, those were my heroes. Celebrities, you know, I don't have any like celebrity worship. My heroes were never celebrities, really. They were artists and artisans, craftspeople, you know, Jonathan Winters, guys like that.
Jonathan Winters is one of those guys when I was a little kid. Jeff, you may be the same, that you just saw him and you started laughing. You didn't even have to hear the singer. He would just make those faces.
Yeah.
And my first impressionist fan, I was a fan of Rich Little. And I think it's because I was supposed to be, because I watched all those shows with my grandparents and my parents, those the Bob Hope shows and things like that. Jeff, your dad was into MASH, so you and stuff like that. So you were watching a lot of sitcoms when you were little, right?
Yeah. My dad was into your show of shows too. He turned that when I was a little kid. Yeah.
Wow. So, I mean, that's a real, real long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll never forget this sketch that I saw, and it really affected me for many reasons. It was called A Drunk There Was, and it was about Sid Caesar. I think he was working in his office, and he told the people, you know, hold all my calls. You know, he's a boss, and he's like shooting baskets, and he's diddling around, but he's fidgety. And eventually you begin to notice that he's itching for a drink. He's dying for a drink. So he looks up, of course, in the lamp up above, a la Lost Weekend with Ray Milland. And then he's looking in the bookcase, you know, and he finds some, and then he's done with that. And then eventually he just runs out of booze, and then he gets this brilliant idea. Wait a minute. And he unscrews the leg of the table, and then it was booze. And I'll never forget that. And it's so funny because my life kind of went in that direction. I know that my dad's did, but when I was 18 or 19, I started drinking and into a fireball. And, you know, so that kind of always had an impact on me. And then eventually when I met Sid Caesar and I got to work with the guy,
wow,
I told him about that story. And he said, yeah, I was gone for years. And I said, yeah, I know. We were out there rooting for you, praying for you. He was the greatest.
Curious how the pandemic has affected the voiceover work. Are you doing everything on Zoom now?
No, not really. I mean, I have a studio in the other room. My brother can engineer like stuff we do for, you know, out of town ad agencies, and they've got a studio on their end and they can record. But most of the stuff, I still have to go into a studio in Los Angeles and, you know, they check your temperature and everything. I don't think we're going to be seeing each other so much as performing individually.
Right.
Which is weird for me because you want to play to your peers, you know, you want them to operate on all eight cylinders so that you can go, oh boy, I gotta be on my toes today, man. You know, a lot of people don't know what it's like to walk in a room full of genius level performers and like, oh my God. Yeah.
When you're together, you're bouncing off, you have that energy together that you're bouncing off. like the first year of the radio, I mean, the pandemic, we spent a good 8 months doing the show from home. And the day we went back in the studio, it was amazing the difference. You can, oh God, I can see my boss now and he can see me and I can pick up on his cues. And
well, Zoom became the biggest thing since sliced bread, you know, because of the pandemic.
Right.
They went from, you know, oh, that's fun, you know, to an integral tool.
I guess it would make it easier working from home by yourself if you're doing, you know, 7 or 8 different characters at the same time.
To me, it don't make no, never mind. You know, yeah. I mean, it's like whatever anybody wants to do is fine with me. I'm very, very lucky, very fortunate that I wound up to do this kind of stuff. You know, it wasn't a plan. It wasn't like, you know, somebody said, how did you get into this? And there were no schools or no teachers. There were no signposts that said, you know, this way to do voiceover. I mean, people didn't even know what it was.
Right.
You know, back in the 50s, in the 60s. But
we knew Will Blank and Casey Kasem and maybe a couple of others. Our generation did. And then now you can do all of them.
I've been very, very lucky. I would prefer to create characters, but I've been asked to replicate or hold up a franchise, you know, keep a franchise going with a copywritten character.
Well, Fry and Zoidberg and
those are the ones that I love the best.
Yes.
Because they just said, they showed me a picture. I mean, everybody got together. They did all the hard work, you know, developing the characteristics and the look and the history and all the hard work. And then they hand it to me and they go, what would you do? And that's when it's the biggest pressure for me. That's the only source of pressure, is you better think long and hard before you open your mouth, mister. You know, you want this to be for the ages. And I go in with that standard in mind. Yeah. Like, oh God, please let me hit the right tone and the right this and that. And I play to them. I go by what I think will turn them on. And if they laugh, then I know that everything is cool.
Did you think right away when you saw a Stimpy that you thought, well, this is going to be a tweak Larry Fine from the Three Stooges?
I didn't think that immediately, but I knew that John Crisfalusi loved this Larry Fine impression that I did. And it caused quite a stir, you know, when I was doing it on the radio. I don't know why. I mean, I guess he's like the Keith Richard of the Stooges, you know?
Yeah.
Hey, Mo, I'm on heroin again. They described to me that the character was childlike and sort of innocent. And I thought, well, I'll try that Larry voice. And John Crisfalusi said, no, he sounds too depressed. So I amped it up, put it way up in the upper register, and it became the voice that everybody knows. Will Button, me, Ren. Shut up, you fool! I shall kill you.
Was it tough to pick up doing Ren after John left the show?
No, I was supposed to do the character in the first place. I auditioned. He gave me a tape of what he wanted the character to sound like, and had all these different, you know, Burl Ives, had Peter Lorre,
yeah.
Kirk Douglas. We're not hitchhiking anymore. Stop or I'll shoot. I told you I'd shoot. you idiot. Yeah, that's Big Daddy, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. And then there was Peter Lorre. I'd like a couple of hamburgers, please, and make them raw.
Jeff was Big Daddy in college, weren't you?
Yeah, and Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Just triggered that memory.
Wow. Did you do a stage version of OK Crackerby after that? I'm taking a big chance. I don't even know if you know what that is. That's, they had Burl Ives on a weekly. He was a detective.
A TV show, or was it a
TV show?
Wow, I didn't know that.
OK Crackerby.
I always wondered after I saw the Three Stooges movie if you had worked with Sean Hayes at all on his Larry Fine impression, because it seemed like he got the voice from you.
Yeah, he did. I was a consultant, and he was great. I mean, he was just like, comes in like a blank slate waiting to be, you know, like clay that hasn't been touched yet. And I just told him, number one, I know you can do this, you know, because I knew how facile he was.
Right.
And And he said, just hit me. And he picked up the voice. He picked up the nasal thing. I told him all the little ins and outs that I knew personally, like Larry was from Philly, and that there were a lot of voice guys, not a lot of guys, a couple of voice guys from Philly. And there's something in the water. They had like some weird glottal nasal thing, like George O'Hanlon, George Jetson. He was from Philly. Oh, come on, Janie, honey. The cleanest 10,000 miles away. It'll take an extra 5 minutes just to get there. You know, and Larry has that, you know, hey, Mo, there's too much tinsel in the tree. Yeah, it's like bad plumbing. And yeah, I mean, I told him all about the Philly thing and he got it. He picked up everything. And I coached Will Sasso a little bit. Yeah, I told him a couple of things I knew that Curly, if you watch Curly run, he limps. He's got a limp and he wasn't doing it for comic effect. It was, although it appeared brilliant, it appeared to be a conscious choice, but it wasn't. He shot himself in the foot when he was 13. You know, that's why he has these scenes where it's always like a gun mishap, you know, firing into a bowl of clam chowder.
Those guys are fantastic. And we got to see him after school. They would never show anything like that now, so violent, you know, maybe a cartoon, but nothing like that. That it was, I mean, we knew it was fake, but still, when you're 7, 8 years old, it's brilliant and fun.
I don't know what they think of kids nowadays. They, you know, yeah, sure, something causes the kid to light his house on fire. Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. You know,
right.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I mean, it's like, okay, you want the TV to be the babysitter, then you're going to raise a little hitman. You're going to raise a little murderer or a fire starter.
Yeah.
Because they don't know from anything else. If you're not parenting, then to hell with you.
Right.
That's what we're protecting people from, cartoons and, you know.
You're protecting them from convicts who escape in the TV that the warden just bought for his wife. Do you remember that old cartoon?
Yeah.
This guy's good. Do you mind if I ask you a little bit about the Stern Show era?
Sure. I don't mind.
That's, I mean, I still have cassette tapes. I don't play them anymore, but I'm never going to get rid of them, that I recorded of that real sweet spot era of when you were on the show and the Jackie puppet and having Al Michaels on and doing whole segments with
all that Michael stuff
and him being a good sport about it.
He was the greatest. He was so cool.
Yeah. He's an interesting cat, and you know,
he really is a super professional.
Nowadays though, he has that, the implant thing. So you got to get a little of the lisp in there that he didn't have before, or did he have it before?
I don't know. I think a lot of announcers, you know, when they were trying to find their style, they would go by who came before them. And a lot of guys were kind of over articulate, but there was this over pronunciation thing. Yeah,
there you go.
Yeah. As if people had cotton in their ears. So you've got to speak louder, you know, and it was resonance and it was kind of authoritarian was the, you know, and Al Michaels said to me, Jesus, Billy, you make me sound like a generic baseball announcer.
Yep. Do people do that? Do people come up to you and quote old bits from the radio?
Yeah, sometimes.
Okay.
Sometimes. I wasn't in good shape when I was there. I was so severely depressed, and it was like I wasn't even at the worst of it yet.
Really?
I hadn't been treated for depression, and I mean, every day I felt like I wanted to die, and it was like the only thing keeping me going was knowing that I could go in there and disappear into the ether. Just give me a cue. Point at me. I'll just, you know.
Was it hard to be on WOR in that condition, the TV show, when they dress you up like Ed McMahon or something?
It held my interest.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, where I could do it for hours upon hours, because that's what they were asking after work, you know, to do a sketch and film it and dress everybody and everything took 12 hours.
Wow.
And then you had to have it for Saturday night or whatever they showed that show.
Yeah, to kick Saturday Night Live's ass for about a year.
Yeah, pretty funny.
Mm-hmm.
No rehearsals.
Right.
Barely any writing.
Gilbert would come in the dice jacket. I remember.
Yes. Oh, God. Yeah. He was just, there's nobody like him.
No. He's still funny, and the show that he does is really funny. And Frank Santopadre knows so much about everything, it seems.
Yeah, I'm fortunate that they have me in, you know, and they like me.
You did two episodes prior, right, to the 400th episode?
I think so, maybe three.
Okay, because I started back from the beginning. I went back, I think, the other day after the episode. I went back and listened to the first one when you're on the phone. And again, Al Lewis, another fantastic one. Jeff, have you heard that one?
Your Al Lewis impersonation? No.
Yeah. Do you mind just a little?
Look what you did, you big dummy. You locked us in the bank vault. Oh, I'm sorry. Goody, goody, goody. He's standing in front of his restaurant down in the West Village, and I would go in there and eat because I knew him. I actually knew the guy. And I'm sitting eating, and there's a young couple sitting next to me, and they have this little adorable girl, and the parents go, go over and ask him where he lives. In other words, go over to Al Lewis and ask him where he lives. And she goes over and she goes, where do you live? And he goes, 1313 Mockingbird Lane. And she screamed and ran back to her table with the parents. And he looks at me and he goes, women.
Also, guys, I wish maybe I'm born a little bit too late, because I think
you were.
I would have been there. I would love to have at one point met Fred Gwynne. He seemed like a nice
person. I met him.
Was he a nice guy?
He was very nice. He was very soft spoken, but I also think that he was fighting cancer at the time, because I happen to know Al Lewis came from the big Yiddish background, you know, and he was huggy and affectionate. And Fred Gwynne was like, you know, from Connecticut, probably like Protestant, and his parents were cold
right
to him. So he didn't know from that. And Al said that, I love the guy. I would kiss him. I would hold him and tell him how wonderful he was. And then I called him up and Fred told me he had cancer. And immediately Al Lewis went, cancer. You had to catch cancer. You couldn't have caught dandruff.
The only person from the show I met was Butch Patrick, and he was
he's a great guy.
He was really cool.
You see him out at the conventions?
Yes, I do.
Yeah,
I love doing the conventions because I get to just meet people that I really have to thank, you know. Thank you for supporting all these shows and get to thank airmen from the Air Force. Three guys in their dress uniform come up and they're big, you know, and they said, yeah, we fly missions over Afghanistan and we do your routines and, you know,
shut up and take my money. Good news, everybody.
Good news, everybody. And they were little boys. They were little boys, you know, and I'm looking at them, thank you for your service. But I mean, they were probably seven.
Oh.
You know?
That's cool, though. That's really,
I think since the pandemic started, the biggest meme I've seen is the, I don't want to live on this planet anymore.
Oh, yeah? Oh, because of the pandemic. Yeah. Yeah, well, that's here to stay, fellas, I think.
Yeah.
If the richest men in the world are actually quoted as saying they doubled their fortunes during the pandemic, then I don't know if there's a whole lot of reason for the pandemic to be made to go away. No. Disaster capitalism, you know. I don't know about this mask, though. I'm triple jabbed. Yeah. I don't know.
I don't either. I'd wear it because you got to at work. But other than that, we live down here where you can go to bowling alley or get a tattoo right after the pandemic started.
Yeah, well, there was a guy on the airplane sitting next to me, and he says, I don't know about this goddamn mask thing. I don't have to wear this shit. This is just shit. This shit ain't shit, this mask. And he says, and I ain't getting no vaccinations either. You know, they put pigeon shit in it, salad dressing, dead babies. You know, and then he was covered with tattoos. I said, so how did these get on you? You know, well, that's different. You know, I said, what if somebody come up with a paint gun and a stencil? You know, but it's always different when it comes to that. Well, that's different.
Right, that's different.
Yeah, I know. I don't want anybody shooting salad dressing and pigeon shit into me. You're right, mister. Look, I'm just kidding, okay? Is it okay to make a joke? Does that make me a bad man? Come on, guys. Give me a break.
Okay.
Come on. Make a joke. Don't cancel me.
You're not canceled. Come over to Truth Social, okay? You'll have your own channel. Billy West, I remember you from Howard. See, it's tough for me to do him. I had to.
I did meet him.
You met him when you were doing Howard?
Yeah, that was a Deadpool moment.
Really?
Yeah, because in my mind, I could see the future.
Oh, man.
He shook his hand.
Yeah.
No, honestly, I got a jolt. I said, can you imagine if this guy ran everything? I just went in there. I wanted to just say hi to him because he is who he is. And he was a big star on TV. Hey, Donald, man, what's it like? He goes, what you like? You know, friend, I'd rather be you right now. I said, why? Do you owe $900 million? He did. He owed $900 million because his right-hand men went down in a helicopter crash over Connecticut just before he went on the show. And but then, as time unfolded, you found out there was a missing $900 million somehow that he had, and then he didn't have it. But I think he tried to pin it on his the loss of his guys, and that it got all jumbled. But, you know, we know better.
He fell off the radar for me. I never was into that reality show. And then all of a sudden,
no, I wasn't either. I don't get that style of life. You know, I think you got to be like a sociopath or something, or a narcissist. Definitely. I mean, thanks to my shithead father, there ain't a narcissist whose head I can't bounce off the sidewalk and do a 3-point shot with. Thank you, Dad. Because narcissists, you know, I mean, Jesus, I mean, it was John Christopher Lucy, all these people, you gray rock them. The minute they're looking for a free meal made out of you,
yes,
gray rock them. You don't feed them anything, and bye-bye.
Did you watch the documentary about John Kay?
Oh, no. No, I have no interest.
I just, from a standpoint of how much I enjoyed the show, I watched it. Boy, what a tragedy that was, the whole thing. But the show was great. I loved the show.
The show was wonderful. I screamed and yelled. And it was very cathartic, but a lot of times I didn't think I was going to make it. I would call my wife. I was married at the time, and I just sounded like Alec Baldwin. Honey, I don't think I'm going to be able to do this show. Honest to God, I mean, honestly.
Yeah.
You know, because I would blow my voice out every day. And then I had to figure out a way to do it, or just, you know, not make it.
Aren't you working on something with one of the writers from Ren and Stimpy?
Mm-hmm. A couple of things. One of them is that I think they did announce that Ren and Stimpy was going to be coming back at some point.
Wow.
So waiting to hear about that. We'll see what happens. But yeah, I mean, I worked with the best people. They were just, you know, they were incredibly driven, artistic. You know, Bill Ray was trained in classical painting. You know, he was a classical painter that used to do all those gross close-up diseased gums.
The zits and the paws. Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes.
That was beautiful art, though.
Beautiful. I have a couple of pieces.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, we're looking forward to that. And we're looking forward to Disenchantment coming back.
Yeah, that's going to be great. I really enjoy that show. I don't have a whole lot to do on the show, but I enjoy it like crazy.
Yeah, I wish you had some more characters.
I don't know. There's plenty of people. They got plenty of people.
Yeah, I don't like when they bring these celebrities in to do voices on stuff. I like when they use the voice people.
Well, I do too. Just, you know. I think
Eric Andre has enough jobs.
Oh yeah, but he's cool. He's cool. He's very energetic, and you know, they hired him for the sound of his voice. He doesn't sound like anybody that I know.
Right.
But I mean, we have all the utility infielders that we need. I mean, with Dave Herman and Maurice LaMarche and Johnny DiMaggio, you know, there isn't anything the four of us can't cover. As far as characters go, coming up with characters or doing impressions.
Who was your first impression, by the way? We jump around a lot, but
I think it was probably Elvis Presley.
Really?
Well, yeah, Heartbreak Hotel. No, Blue Suede Shoes was on the radio.
Okay.
And I used to listen to it. It was brand new, this Elvis. I was jumping up and down on the bed with my dad's rain shoes on, the galoshes, you know.
Yeah.
Pretending they were the blue suede shoes, and I was singing along with the record. Yeah. That's like, it had to be 1956.
Wow.
Yeah.
I have to laugh because on that last episode of Gilbert, where you and Dave Thomas were doing, now the Lucy bit, I love. I have a recording of that. Or a copy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the old bit, yeah.
Calling from the hospital, but to marry that and then just doing improv with him as he's doing Bob Hope, that was great too.
Oh, I'm glad you like that.
I just,
how sick is that?
Back then, I heard it then, and I was like, wow, holy shit. Not only does it sound like her, but it's like, whoa. You know, she had heard that. Oh,
well, you know what? In her prime, she wouldn't have thought anything of it.
No, she would have loved it, probably.
You know, if there was a bunch of nuts on the radio ragging on Tallulah Bankhead dying or, you know, who knows?
Yeah.
I mean, they were rocketeers themselves, you know?
Yeah, I watched that movie. I don't know how accurate it was, but Nicole Kidman did a good job mimicking her voice.
That's what I heard. That's what I heard. I kind of like it when they do get it right like that.
Javier Bardem did not, and he didn't look like him at all either, which was very distracting. I kept thinking of, you know, the guy from No Country for Old Men. So.
Oh, right. Right. Yeah, that left a permanent mark.
And J.K. Simmons is, I don't know his real name. I just know him as Fred. I forget his real name. But he did okay, I thought.
Oh, William Frawley.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I did all right.
But the Sam Hill, Rick. Eric. Lucy's losing her mind again.
He shouldn't have hit her so hard, Rick. That's from Stern. I don't know. That might have been you or Fred. I don't know. We'll let you get back to life. Here in a second, but we want to, you know, give you an opportunity to plug anything you have. Jeff got me a cameo from you for my 40th or 50th birthday, so I still
Wow, thank you.
Yeah, plug your cameo for people. I'm sure people would be interested.
Yeah, Cameo is that service where you can you know, look up and see if there's anybody that you admire or hate even, and you can get a message from them for whatever occasion. You know, as long as they're not filthy dirty, I guess. Yeah, that's a fun thing to do. I enjoy it. But it's like, at least I get to hear from people. You know, I like reading Twitter, and I've got some Facebook time that I'll go and read comments. And people have been just so darn nice to me over the years, you know.
Well, you're a treasure to us. Certainly, I mean, 2-3 generations, man, from all your voice work throughout the years. I mean, your IMDb is way too long to list everything. There's just so much in there. I mean, we touch on, you know, doing the Hanna-Barbera voices and Scooby and, you know, plus the stuff we've already talked about, but so many generations you've affected. And then right in that wheelhouse of when Gen X came of age, teenage years and early 20s, to listen to you on the radio and then to hear you go on throughout the 90s and be on all the shows we love. So, I mean, to us, certainly to me, talking to you like this is like meeting a hero. And
oh, thank you so much. Awesome. So nice of you to say. I mean, I'm deeply thankful and grateful for everybody that hung in, you know.
Yeah. Well, we'd love to have you on anytime. You have anything you want to promote, even if you want to just come on for 2 minutes. We will.
Yes. Sure, absolutely.
And do voices like Bill Macy and
I'm glad you did that. That's made my day.
I was hoping to get a little George Takei off going, but maybe we're running out of that.
Are we even allowed to do him?
You sound like him.
Well, Brad's penis was erect. And I...
Oh, that's so great.
And
sound just like him. Coming up on Rigel 7, Captain. Rigel 7. You need some Oxy 5.
You know, back when Bill, and that here's how he always says Bill.
I know. You do him way better than I do.
Yeah, but yours was funnier. I can remember that when he was in the studio, and I don't want to quote the line, but.
Well, I know him. I know Shatner, and I saw him at a Comic-Con about 2 months ago. And, And he was zipping around. He's 90 years old. Yeah. And that guy was doing television when I was sitting in my own shit. You know, he's taken quite a big bite out of life. I mean, he's never not been with us.
Yeah.
And so I see him hopping around, and I went to go shake hands with him, but he went up, up, and he made a fist, you know, like, in other words, I'm not shaking your hand. He looks at the snack bar and he goes, I'm going to have a cookie. he went and had a cookie. Then he went, I'm going to have another cookie. and he has that, you know, and it was just so funny just watching him. But he was super friendly. And then a week later, he was orbiting the Earth, or not orbiting the Earth, but he went up and down in the spaceship with Jeff Bezos.
Right.
And I thought that was pretty wild, you know. And he was, when I saw him, and he said, I was crying. I'm an actor. I should be able to control that. And I was crying. I was helpless. It's so dark. You're looking at death. You look at the Earth. It's alive. Yeah. You know, and I said, you know what? I'd be crying too if I rode a giant dildo into space at 2,500 miles an hour and back. Oh, I'd be crying and screaming too.
Well, that he did that. We were on air when he did that, so we were watching and talking about it. And then when he came back down, they were trying.
I was crying.
Yeah, he was crying, but there was some. Okay, everybody, let's go talk about. Yeah, it was Bezos' wife. Or something that. They're all screaming, and man, you just want to hear the emotion.
I want to be part of history. I have a lot to contribute, you know.
yeah, we know.
Thanks so much for taking your time,
Dan. Yeah, man.
Thank you, guys.
And to follow you on Twitter, it's at the Billy West. Is that right?
At the Billy West.
All right. Thank you so much, Billy, and continued success. And
cheers. Again, for same all to you guys. Thank you very, very much. Take care.
Try again.